Hi, everybody. I'm Nobody, and welcome to the July 30th, 1997 edition of the Nobody Show, your unabashed voice of the left and left out, beaming the gospel of steely-eyed compassion from my station to my nation and out beyond the edge of darkness to the dawn of hope. Well, you know, I don't like to do on this show what everybody does everywhere, but sometimes you just can't get away from it. Sometimes issues are so compelling that you really just have to discuss them no matter how frequently they're being discussed on stations everywhere across the country. So tonight I am taking a break from my continuing coverage of the Guardian Industries move into Geneva. I think that there will be almost certainly some more issues to be raised in connection with that in the coming weeks, but not this week. And instead, I am going to devote almost the whole show, maybe the whole show. It's 2 hours. I'm not going to have a guest in the second hour. I'll have a guest only for a part of the first hour. I am going to discuss on this show for the whole time an issue which I'm sure you're hearing everywhere else around the dial, but what the heck? I mean, is this the time or not to talk about the rather obvious links between the national budget and sodomy? Now, the fact that this is being discussed elsewhere, what can I do? We're just in the situation where we really have to look at this issue, and it's an issue with great complexity and depth. And we will cover it in all of its depth tonight. We will talk about that. Those numbers to call in here are 800-213-WEOS, 800-213-WEOS, or 781-3897, 781-3897. But before we get into this, I want to warm up to the topic, so to speak, by asking you to share with me, if you want to call in, your reminiscences about that day when you remember and you turned on the television and there was President Clinton in a poor rural area to which he had flown to make an historic speech about this controversial incinerator that was being built there, and saying that it is not right to keep putting these incinerators in poor areas. Poor people are not the sponges for the toxic waste of the wealthy in our society. And we have to draw a line here in the fields of this community and say, no more toxic waste for the poor. Let's share the responsibility for the waste of our own society. Let's manage it better, and let's not make it a class issue. No, the EPA will not license this incinerator. This is where it stops. Well, I gave you the numbers here to call in, 800-213-WEOS or 781-3897. I'm here all 2 hours. I got you want to reminisce about that. It kind of chokes me up too. So to go ahead and call in, or call in if you want to talk about the time when the president flew down to Three Mile Island for that famous speech, where he pointed to Three Mile Island and he said, "Look how close we came to a catastrophe that could have affected life in an area hundreds of miles around, maybe cost us the state of Pennsylvania, no small matter." And let's set aside our drive for growth at any price and recognize that there are limits to what we can do safely. And risking a state or two is not safe. And I am announcing today that the federal government is going to immediately clamp down on the nuclear power industry. We're going to take offline every year for the next 10 years the 10 most dangerous plants in the country, and we're just going to start closing them down and put federal monitors in them 24 hours a day so we never face a risk like that. Just making more money and expanding the economy and having, you know, bigger and better everything isn't worth the risk in terms of real human lives that this could cost. I'm not saying it, of course, as eloquently as Clinton did, but anybody wants to call in tonight and shed a tear or two, I kind of get weepy about it, and talk about that famous Clinton speech, well, sure. I mean, you know, it's, you can't talk enough about these things. And what about that speech Clinton gave down in California, right on the border with Mexico? when he, I always remember, I thought it was a dramatic touch when he got out that big pair of binoculars and he was looking across at the toxic waste dump in the Maquiador zones of Mexico, the one that was leaking the toxic wastes right into the United States. And then in front of the reporters, he put the binoculars down and said, you know, you don't need a binocular to see this. You can see it just right up close with your naked eye. You can see how NAFTA, the side agreements that we were forced into, and I'm so glad we were, for the environment, have failed. We weren't aggressive enough to protect the environment. You can see that corporations are using the Maquiador zones as places where they can simply escape environmental regulation. It's really quite disgusting to just see the 55-gallon drums of ooze leaking there, and they don't even bother to hide the drums in Mexico. There's no policing at all. Now, this pollution, tragic as it may be enough for the Mexicans, is now even leaching back into our own country, things that would be totally forbidden here. And no matter how devoted I have been to NAFTA, I have to say this hasn't worked. And if we have to re-examine the whole deal, we will, because we're not going to let these poisons leach into our country, nor are we going to have it on our consciences that we have collaborated in setting up a zone where poor Mexicans are driven by their own financial desperation to work nonstop amidst a toxic stew which can only shorten their lifespans and probably will pass on ill effects to their offspring and maybe contaminate the homes in which they are struggling to bring up their children. No, the United States will have no part of that. Well, what can I say? I guess everybody knows these moments never happened. But Clinton did fly somewhere to make a speech about the environment. He didn't give any of those speeches. He gave a very different speech. He flew to Lake Tahoe. And he hid in plain sight what he was doing. He told everybody what he was doing. But when the president is up to something, and he tells people what it is, it doesn't even get reported anyway. So he's kind of pretty safe. We can talk at length about the corporate media and what that means to have major news organizations that don't report the news, and we are going to talk about that a little. Don't report it properly. But you can't blame the president. He said, if I could be quite candid here, he said, in Lake Tahoe. And he was candid. He flew down to Lake Tahoe, and I'm sure you all saw this on the evening news or heard it on the radio, to talk about a new initiative to clean up Lake Tahoe. When he left, the environmentalists grumbled that he hadn't given them as much as they needed, but never mind. He said, if I could be quite candid here, one of the reasons that I wanted to come here was not only to highlight to the nation the importance of Lake Tahoe, but also to show the nation that there is a place where environmentalists and business people and ordinary citizens, where Republicans and Democrats, where tribal leaders and governmental people, where everybody is working together in common cause, recognizing that there cannot be an artificial dividing line between preserving our natural heritage and growing our economy. That is the fundamental lesson as Americans we have to absorb if we hope to be able to have our grandchildren and our grandchildren's grandchildren 100 years from now celebrating the kind of country we're celebrating on the edge of this new century. This is the lesson we have to absorb that he flew to Lake Tahoe for this photo op to get across to us. There cannot be an artificial dividing line between preserving our natural heritage and growing our economy. In other words, Clinton, who did not fly anywhere to any of the obvious sites and the dozens more I didn't mention, to talk about how greed is despoiling the earth and destroying the future, not to mention the present, and especially for our poorest and most vulnerable citizens, never got off his butt to do that, has flown somewhere to talk about how important it is not to have an artificial dividing line between preserving our natural heritage and growing our economy. That's the principle. We have all of the environmentalism in this country that will be in the best interests of corporations. That's going to be the new message. So the sites where the corporations are polluting and it's not in anybody's best interest but theirs, we're not going to talk about those sites. We're not going to fly to those sites. We're not going to highlight those sites. And by the way, Lake Tahoe used to be one of them. This is from the Times on July 25th. 10 or 15 years ago, there were tremendous clashes between the business interests here and the environmentalists, said Rochelle Nason, executive director of the League to Save Lake Tahoe, a 40-year-old nonprofit group. Today, we're seeing a lot of common ground because local businesses realize the environment is their bread and butter. Lake Tahoe is a tourist destination. So what happened in Lake Tahoe is that the businesses waited till the last minute. They didn't want to hear anything about Save the Lake until it got to the point where, through their thick skulls, they realized this might hurt business. They never cared about the lake. They care about business. And the president flew to Lake Tahoe so that he could underscore this, that that's the principle. That's the principle. There cannot be an artificial dividing line between preserving our natural heritage and growing our economy. And do you know what? I agree with him. There can't be an artificial dividing line between preserving our natural heritage and growing our economy, because there should be a natural dividing line. And the natural dividing line is that when the growing economy is destroying the planet has to come first. Now, in case you think that this is just incidental, in case you think, oh, I'm just pulling out of this one point, never mind that Clinton said he was candid about it, let me read you, this is Al Gore's introductory remarks to the president. This was their theme of the day. Lake Tahoe demonstrates clearly that the economy is the environment, and the environment is the economy. You know, these are the kinds of things Orwell couldn't write. You know what I mean? Truth is stranger than fiction kind of stuff. Orwell couldn't write that. War is peace and peace is war. Yeah, that was kind of obvious. But Lake Tahoe demonstrates clearly that the economy is the environment and the environment is the economy. You kind of have to be there. Do you know what I mean? You have to kind of actually be living it. Novelists can't make that up. That's kind of like incredible that somebody would get there. Well, obviously, everybody in the country isn't talking about the links between the national budget and sodomy, which I am going to talk about later on. And this is the prelude to it. But I don't think that link is any more obscure than the link between the economy and the environment, and the environment is the economy. Think about this for a second, how absurd this is. Is there anything, like, if the economy does well, does the environment do well? Well, actually, you know, if the economy does badly and people can't afford to drive their cars, in that sense, the environment does better because there's less pollution. Now, you could argue that if the economy does badly, certain things will suffer. People might skimp on pollution controls and stuff and dump toxic wastes illegally more. They may be more tempted to do that and cut corners. But, you know, that's going on now, and the economy is ostensibly going well. So a direct relationship between the economy and the environment would be really difficult to come up with. I mean, you know, this is the kind of person you don't want teaching your kids. You know what I mean? I mean, this is the kind of person who's going to, I don't know, I don't want to be obscene about this, but this is the kind of person who's going to touch a little girl in the wrong place and say it's normal. Do you know what I mean? Oh, this is what every uncle does. Because this is the same kind of thinking. Like, who's going to believe this? But this is their theme. The economy is the environment, and the environment is the economy. Now, I don't really want to pick on the speechwriter for both of them. You know, Clinton always gets into his little specific proposals. He'll never get into this larger question of the ways in which the economy is not the environment, right? By the way, in case anybody really doesn't get the subtlety of this, and I know my listeners do, let us remember that the environment existed for eons before the economy existed at all. It's quite amazing for something that existed for billions of years to be the same thing as something that's existed only for a blip, historically speaking. So Clinton is saying, we will help to cut down on traffic congestion and auto pollution by joining with you to improve mass transit throughout the region. I'm pleased to report that the U.S. Postal Service will help by switching to cleaner natural gas trucks and expanding home mail delivery to people on the west side of the lake. The Sierra Nevada's legendary 19th century mail carrier, Snowshoe Thompson, would probably be proud of that. Well, can we talk about lame here? Do you really think if you brought somebody back from the 19th century, when the time when Lake Tahoe had no cars, had no pollution, had no casinos, had no jet skis on the lake, and you brought him back and you showed him all that, and he'd say, yes, I'm really proud to see the Postal Service is switching to natural gas. And I don't want to pick on the lame speech writer, but it isn't just lameness. You know, Wordsworth said that poetry was the spontaneous overflow of powerful emotion, and oratory is the same thing. And if you find yourself in a position, unlike Lincoln at Gettysburg, if you find yourself in a position where you're meandering around a subject saying absurdities and throwing in even more absurd little laugh lines, maybe it's because you're not in touch with authentic emotion. And the reason they're not in touch with authentic emotion, and the reason why Clinton is no Roosevelt, is because he's not doing the things Roosevelt did. Roosevelt's great oratory grew out of a genuine concern for humanity. Yes, a flawed man in many ways, but never mind. Well, this is not genuine. The economy is nature and all that. Nature is, again, this theme came up in his, he said, Clinton said, we cannot divide our quest for prosperity from our obligation to hand nature, God's great gift to us, on down to the generations. We cannot divide our quest for prosperity from our obligation to hand nature, God's great gift to us, on down to the generations. Well, of course we can divide the two. Who says we can't divide them? I'm ready to divide them right now. If your priority, you know, is handing on nature to future, then let's do it, and let's not let economic activity encroach on this. But Clinton never left any doubt who he was talking to. He closed his remarks, his last line, except for thank you and God bless you. Thank you was, and you may be sure I will be giving you a lot of free publicity around the country in the days and months ahead. He saw himself as speaking to an audience that wanted publicity. Who wants publicity in Lake Tahoe? Do you think the people who are really concerned about the growth of algae in Lake Tahoe, they're looking for publicity? It's the casinos. It's the tourist people who want publicity. That's who he thought his audience was. And it was their interests he was representing to the country, he and Gore. Well, this is hardly the first time we've had a consensus nobody consented to in this country. We have all of these people being thrown off of welfare. We have all of these people being thrown off of food stamps. And now there's this great test. Rush Limbaugh has said, well, I don't see any people fighting in the streets. I've said this before. That was his big remark. Like, that's the test. Dying in the streets, we don't care. But fighting in the streets, that's a sign something is wrong. The New York Times jumped on the bandwagon on July 6th of this year. Cut off from food stamps, but not flocking to soup kitchen. And let me read you a little of this. I have a guest on the line. We're going to talk about this just a little bit. When word spread that hundreds of unemployed, able-bodied adults would soon lose food stamps, this city's advocates took to the streets. This is from Syracuse Dateline. They taped warnings on grocery store windows. They pinned flyers on community bulletin boards, and then the soup kitchens braced for the deluge of the hungry. It never happened. More than 500 people have vanished from the food stamp rolls since March, when Syracuse became one of the first cities in New York to deny those benefits to childless, able-bodied adults who failed to find work. But only a handful responded to the offer for help, etc., etc. Well, on the phone I have Tom Slater, the executive director of the Food Bank of Central New York, who is based in Syracuse. Mr. Slater, welcome to the Nobody Show.
Thank you very much.
Were you able to hear the intro? I'm not sure from the status on the board if you could hear what I was reading from the Times.
I could hear that.
Well, did the Times get the story right?
No, they didn't.
All right. What's the story?
Well, I think they interviewed the wrong people. There's two types of people that receive emergency food assistance. And that's the families that go to food pantries and they receive groceries that take care of their needs for a few days. And then there's single able-bodied people that go to soup kitchens and receive a hot meal for a day. So I think they interviewed the food pantries and didn't see an increase, but neglected the soup kitchens, which have seen an increase.
Now, why would the soup kitchens be the place we would see this increase?
Because the food stamp law that went into effect affected the 18 to 50-year-old able-bodied single adults that were able to work.
So it was actually not the families who would be likely to be at the food pantries. It was the single people who would be likely to show up at the soup kitchens who were affected by that.
That's correct, sir.
Well, and now what was the effect at the soup kitchens? What have you seen?
In downtown Syracuse, which is the main part of Onondaga County, we've seen a 33% increase in the use in soup kitchens.
So actually, if the Times had had this thing right, it would have said, instead of cut off from food stamps but not flocking to soup kitchen, it would have said, one-third rise in soup kitchen use following food stamp cutoff.
That's correct.
That's quite a different headline.
Well, you know the press.
Well, I'm part of it. I mean, you know, and I would like to think that we can do better than that. And this is an issue in terms of why are the media covering this or not covering this. Have the Syracuse papers, has anybody other than me, has anybody asked you about this?
We have had a newspaper article regarding it, and even they didn't get it completely straight. I ended up sending an editorial, which they were kind enough to print, and I helped to clarify some points on the issue.
Okay, but the main, the overview you would have then is that this is being, I won't say you swept under the rug, but it's not getting out. That you're seeing an actual consequence of these policies, and the word is not getting out as far as you're concerned.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I think what a lot of people don't understand is that there was already a large use in the emergency food network on people that are on assistance, mm-hmm. that the food stamps was never intended to meet the total food needs of people. And so they were already participating in the emergency food network, going to pantries and soup kitchens. Now they're going to be forced to go to these more often, which is going to put a huge strain on the private not-for-profit network.
Well, now you are part of that private not-for-profit network, and you get some of your funds from federal government, state government. Where does your money come from, if I may ask?
Oh, sure, you may.
Okay.
Yes, we receive both food and funds from the federal government through the Emergency Food Assistance Program.
Okay,
and that's where the federal government buys food commodities, and then they distribute them throughout the United States, mostly through food banks.
Okay.
And they pay some administrative funds, but recently the state changed my formula
mm-hmm.
without any discussion, and that would send an additional $1.5 million to New York City, and we will lose $85,000 for no other reason than some bureaucrat making that decision.
Well, maybe they weren't getting enough in the city. I don't know, but there wasn't enough to go around. I won't even comment on that. I know that the soup kitchens in the city are not going to tell us that they are overflowing with cash and don't know what to do with it.
Absolutely.
So, but in any case, were you overflowing with cash? Did you have $85,000 more than you needed before?
Absolutely not.
Well, how strapped are you up there? I'm going to assume that you're not flush. So, how bad is it?
Well, we're going to try and raise money through private corporations, businesses, and we've never done that before.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure anybody else has been able to do that much either. I mean, you know, but good luck. I want to wish you good luck. I don't want to sound like a facetious about it, but if corporations really cared about people starving to death, they might have lobbied to change our national priorities instead of doing what they've done, which is make all the money come to them.
That's true, but that's what the federal government is telling the United States of American citizens, that when the government cuts back, that industry will step forward and help the poor.
That's, well, has it been happening? You haven't asked them. Have they been rushing to come to you?
I know for a fact that no one has stepped forward to help us.
So it hasn't happened in Syracuse?
Not at all. And we represent 11 counties in New York State, not just Onondaga County.
This great spirit of voluntarism among corporations has not materialized.
Well, it's like the Volunteer Summit, that's a two-edged sword. It's a wonderful tribute to the people that have a willingness to give their most precious commodity, which is their time, and they're to be commended for that. But to think that volunteers can step forward and take care of the basic needs that government is responsible to put forth, it's unrealistic.
See, I have this kind of guilt that I'm talking to you about this, and I mean, this may sound strange, but But I think to myself, well, everybody's going to know this is a put-up job. You know, this guy, of course, is saying things, this Tom Slater is saying things that I would want to hear said, and it's just unethical for me to be talking to a guy on the phone who actually has as his major preoccupation whether or not people get to eat, you know? What a terrible thing. I should be talking to somebody more responsible than someone who is just concerned about whether or not families and people have enough food.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, you're not probably considered a good enough expert for people or something.
Well, we went to some experts to help us. We went to Tufts researchers,
uh-huh.
and they did a study on what the effect of the federal cuts is going to be.
Uh-huh.
And they found from the food stamp cuts from 1997 to the year 2002, that will amount to a $27 billion cut. And that's equivalent to withdrawing nearly 24 billion pounds of food from the poor. Or an average of about 4 billion pounds of food a year.
What does that mean per poor person?
Well, I'll tell you what it means in terms of food, and then we can talk about per poor person.
Okay.
If we were to take 24.5 billion pounds of food, we would fill nearly 5 million Army National Guard trucks. And if we put them in a typical military convoy, it would go through space to the moon and back in 4.5 times around the world.
That is how much food is now being taken away from the poor?
Through this food stamp cuts.
That is staggering.
And that's enough food to feed the entire population for the state of Texas 3 meals a day for a year.
That is staggering.
Yes, it is. And for them to think that Second Harvest, which is our national organization, which is the network of food banks, to pick up that is unrealistic. That would be a 425% increase in our capacity. And we've already lost donations because with the use of information technology, food manufacturers are becoming a lot more efficient in the way they do things, so there's less food waste that used to be donated to us.
Now, is it possible, because I assume you're in touch with this, that the companies up in Syracuse, they're just a bunch of slugs, but really every place else, corporations are rushing to make up the slack that the government is pulling back from?
No, I'm speaking from a national point of view. Second Harvest is the third largest nonprofit organization in the United States. It's the first anti-hunger organization in the United States, and they're the ones that have had the significant drop in food donations.
And this, so you're sure this is all across? These reports are coming in everywhere. They're losing food aid, and people are coming in. Do you think more people are coming everywhere now for food aid? Is this
what
you're hearing?
Yes, sir.
This is a national trend.
Yes, sir. And we found that more and more, it's not people that are on welfare or people that are unemployed, but actually some of the working poor, because of the high cost of living in the Northeast. You have high utility bills in the winter, you have high rent costs. The only discretionary cost they have is food, and so they choose not to spend their money on food. They try and keep their shelter and their heat. So they come to the Emergency Food Network to meet their food needs, both themselves and their family.
Now, let me ask you about trends. First of all, are there some people in danger? If this keeps up, are we in danger of seeing people have real starvation here?
I think that there could be a strong adverse effect because the nature of food donations anyhow are not always the best types of food. I think that food banks can do better in getting better foods. We've made a concerted effort to try and get more produce into the diets of the poor because that has long-term health effects.
Mm-hmm.
Just for example, a child, if they don't eat well, the body goes into a triage effect, and it tries to keep the organism alive, and then it tries to keep the height and the growth. And that's why you find a lot of kids in the inner city, they don't meet the height and the growth.
In other words, the body stops growing, but you live.
Right. And then the third thing that the food does, it allows them to interact in their environment. So if they're meeting the first part and they're meeting the second part and they're still not meeting the third, that means you're delivering a child to school that's unable to learn, unable to get along with his schoolmates, unable to interact with the teacher. So you're spending billions of dollars on education to a shell of a child.
It's like I said, I'm talking to a guy who wants kids to eat, you know? I mean, so I guess I can commiserate with you. I'd like kids to eat. I mean, does that make something wrong with me, I wonder? Because I'm here screaming about this. I mean, I know you're only on this show tonight, and you wouldn't know that. You can't hear me up in Syracuse. But it staggers me that this could be a line in the Times, you know? Nobody's going, like, nothing is happening. We're taking all these, you know, millions of trucks equivalent out of the food chain. Nothing is happening. Do you have any reason to believe it's going to get any worse?
No, I don't. Well, worse, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Because now, as they lower the responsibility down from the federal government to the state government to the local government, then you're going to have the adverse race to the bottom. People are not going to want people to move into their counties, so they're going to give lower benefits. And in the hopes that people will either move out of their county and no one will move in.
They'll move to some more generous place instead. They'll
right.
Punish
so
the poor.
The race to the bottom happens.
And this is going on now, you think?
Well, in tonight's paper, they're talking about the state budget agreement, and the New York State is going to allow individual counties to restore benefits to legal immigrants, and Onondaga County is choosing not to do that.
It's I don't know what to say. It's sickening. That's what it is.
Now, yeah, they interviewed a 77-year-old man that doesn't know how he's going to eat.
Now, this is happening. All right, we should also remember this is happening in the most abundant agricultural country in the history of the world and the richest country in the history of the world. So there is food there, and this is the obvious thing, and we should say the obvious thing. Now, and it's also obvious that this is happening at a time of, never mind all the tricks in the economy, low unemployment, record high stock market. If the stock market were to crash or we were to have a recession, the demands on your system obviously would be quite high compared to what they are now.
Right. Yeah, that's probably the most disheartening part, is even when you have a public figure stand up like Secretary Glickman and he says, we're going to try and reduce hunger by the year 2015. I mean, what kind of a promise is that? I mean, here we are, we're a rich country, we're a democratic government, we're a world leader. It's not like we don't have the resources or the know-how. What we do lack is public leadership that'll just stand forward and cure this disease called hunger. I mean, we just put something on Mars.
Yeah. You know, we used to say we could put a man on the moon. Now we can say we put something on Mars. But the same problems are not being tended to. Tom, I really want to make this clear to my listeners, because I know the answer to this, but I really want the listeners to understand this. As you go around, you talk to people, are we talking about a situation, A, where there are factions in the food bank movement, where there are some organizations and some people say, oh, everything's going to be fine and there's plenty of stuff coming in, and there are other factions like yourself who say, well, I don't know, we're not seeing this stuff come in and it looks like we got a problem. So there's disagreement there. Are we saying, B, not just your organization, all the people who actually work on the ground dealing with hungry people are saying we have a serious problem here and it looks like it's only going to get worse and we're not going to be able to feed everyone. Is it A or is it B that there's consensus about this?
There's definitely consensus in the nonprofit world through Second Harvest that we're not going to be able to handle this need.
But other organizations too. There's no major food bank organization or anti-poverty, you know, non-governmental organization. Nobody out there is painting a rosy scenario right now, to your knowledge.
Oh, not at all, sir. I mean, all the major organizations, FRAC, Bread for the World, all of us have combined together to ask for new legislation to restore these cuts in child nutrition programs as well as food stamps, because we understand that Second Harvest can't take a 425% increase in their capacity to feed people when we're already not feeding everyone in need. It's estimated to be 30 million hungry Americans, and we're reaching 26 million through our network.
It's staggering to me.
It's
And while there is real consensus among the anti-poverty organizations such as your own and the food banks that we've got a desperate, serious problem here, the irony is that there's a kind of consensus in Washington that this is all going to take care of itself, which is all you ever hear from everybody. So doesn't that make you kind of angry when you hear them talking about things that you know better?
Well, I understand the climate of 1997, and it's that the current welfare system doesn't work, and so they want to change it. And in the midst of change, the pendulum has swung, and in our expertise, it has swung too far, and they're playing with people's lives in a country that they don't have to, and that's what's so upsetting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but
I understand.
I understand the need for change. I'm just thinking they should take care of their weakest citizens.
But you're not saying that the way to change is not necessarily by making everybody just go cold turkey and have no food. That's not the direction to go in.
Absolutely not. I mean, this is a time when actually it's going to have adverse effects down the road. When your weakest citizens are not able to learn in school, how are you going to be able to compete in a global economy in the future, when they're not prepared and other countries are taking care of their own? It's a sad commentary on the United States. And just as Clinton apologized for the sexual disease experimentation, and the British Prime Minister apologized for the consequences of the Irish potato famine. I believe that someone will be apologizing for this in the near future.
Well, it couldn't be near enough for me, and doing something about it. Mr. Slater, if somebody wants to get in touch with the organization, is there a phone number they can do that if they want to make a contribution or find out where to help or whatever?
I'd appreciate that, because for every dollar in donations, we're able to distribute $14 worth of food. We're a very efficient organization. As I said, we serve 575 nonprofit agencies in 11 counties, and we only have 20 paid employees. So if they could give us a call at 315-437-1899, we'd be happy to tell them how to help.
You want to repeat that?
315-437-1899.
All right. Well, I really want to thank you very much for giving a dose of, I guess it's brutal reality, but it's a dose that people need to the Nobody Show and to my listeners, and I just want to thank you very much for taking the time to join us here.
Thank you for the opportunity, and I hope that I can come back when things are better.
Well, and if they don't get better, I hope you'll come back and tell the truth about that, too.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Good talking.
Bye-bye.
All right, those numbers to call in here again are 800-213-WEOS or 781-3897. You know, I honestly feel a little guilty. Like, I feel guilty. Like I'm doing something wrong to bring the truth into the discussion here. We're having this great national debate. We're having this great, well, I shouldn't say debate. We're having a great national consensus. I, of course, talk on this show all the time about the national psychosis, and you can file the national consensus right under the national psychosis. This is the truth. We are creating hunger. I mean, what do you want? You're talking to the people who are there distributing the food. The New York Times is not even reporting it correctly, and other papers aren't reporting it at all, and all Rush Limbaugh has to say is they're not fighting in the streets. Now, maybe out there you will begin to get a glimmer of what I am getting at when I say talking about the relationship between the national budget and sodomy, because, in fact, we are talking about the relationship between the national economic priorities and the national moral priorities. And is there a relationship between those two? Which, yes, there is. Yes, there is. And if we had a set of national moral priorities that said something about we must not be letting children go hungry in the richest nation and the most agriculturally abundant nation on earth, you'd also have a different set of economic priorities enshrined in the budget. But this plays out in infinite detail, no matter where you look in contemporary American society. And we'll look. Numbers again are 800-213-WEOS or 781-3897. Well, I may be here saying let's bring the truth into this matter, but that's not what they're out there in Washington. Not out there in Washington where they have the slogan of let's clean up all the pollution that's profitable to clean up. Well, that isn't what they said, but it comes to the same thing. Let's see. They cut back on Medicare. Okay, President Clinton, this is the Times of the 23rd of this month. President Clinton today vowed to defend the vote of any member of Congress, Democrat or Republican, who supported raising premiums for the affluent elderly. My best judgment is that a big majority of the American people will support this, the president said. They understand how big the baby boom retirement generation is. They understand how large the subsidy is on Medicare, and I would be happy to defend the vote of any member of Congress, Democrat or Republican, who votes for this. Big help Clinton is. Well, there it is. There's this big majority. This big majority. I don't remember being consulted as part of that big majority. But everybody now knows, you know, it's like we've come to the ultimate thing in democracy. You don't even, you know, not only have we now lost where we have the money so dominates the elections, if you have anything real to say, you haven't got a chance anyway, but now the elections aren't needed because a guy like Clinton, all he has to do is call up the Psychic Friends Network and he knows what everybody is thinking. So why have an election? Well, on July 6th, he said, this Independence Day, I mean, no, that's the Times reported it. He said it, I guess, on the 5th or the 4th, it must have been, even though it's got a dateline on the 5th. This Independence Day, he said, all Americans should be very happy that 3 million of our fellow citizens are now off welfare rolls. This Independence Day, all Americans should be very happy that 3 million of our fellow citizens are now off welfare rolls. Well, we just spoke to a guy. Am I supposed to be happy about that? This is what I'm being told. This guy is saying someday someone's going to have to apologize. This is a crime. And I'm being told that I ought to be happy about it. This is really happy talk carried to a, well, what can I say? I don't want to overwear the word here, but a psychotic extreme. That's what's going on. And we've barely scratched the surface. Those numbers to call in here again are 800-213-WEOS or 781-3897. Joe from Ithaca, welcome to the Nobody Show.
Thank you. I think you're forgetting that you're nobody. And when you say that Clinton didn't consult you, Clinton isn't speaking for you, that's because you're not one of the Americans. The Americans are Clinton's buddies that he knows and talks to because they pay to talk to him. And everybody else doesn't exist in his mindset.
Well, that you're correct. That is why this is the Nobody Show. But let's face it, I'm in the majority.
And the majority of people don't count in Washington politics.
I am not disputing it. You're absolutely right. But, you know, somewhere in there I am trying to make the point about what ought to count. And mm-hmm. And where is our bottom moral line here? If people are now malnourished, children can't learn in school because we're cutting back and there's no food and nothing can fill up that slack. Is there the reason that you have this false reporting, the reason that you have everybody being so happy about this and never telling the truth about it is because I think everybody recognizes if you tell the truth, it's not explainable. You cannot say it's all right to make children starve. You can't say that's all right, and I think we ought to keep that before us.
It's absolutely. I mean, how could you explain why someone who's making $15 million a year, which my understanding is the average CEO salary at this point, why they deserve a tax break? What relief does someone earning someone who's receiving $15 million a year, what relief do they need except, you know, help to carry their wallet around?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. That's a very good question.
People don't hear that. They just hear that tax relief is being brought to the Americans. Well, again, I'm not one of those Americans that's getting a tax relief. In fact, almost all of them aren't.
Well, let's ask this question. Why are we having jubilation in Washington about having reached a national budget on which the Republicans and Democrats agree? Here again, the consensus to which we didn't consent, they're cutting capital gains back to 20%. My feeling is soak the rich. Where did I ever agree to this?
Mm-hmm. Because you're not one of those Americans. It's back to the whole nobody thing. You're a nobody. You don't exist. You aren't part of that consensus. Because you don't matter.
They're peeling back inheritance taxes. You know, this is kind of a long-term issue, inheritance taxes. There are people who've got a kind of philosophy about that.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about the root issue about inheritance taxes is not just about family dynasties. It's about exempting wealth from taxation and placing the burden of taxation on income and not on wealth.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you stole $1 billion yesterday and it wasn't taxable, it can't be taxed tomorrow. You can sit on your billion, but if you earn $10 today, well, we're going to tax your $10 because that's income, but we're not going to tax wealth. Wealth is something that's already been accumulated. That's part of what this trend is. Well, if you want to get the money back, you got to tax wealth. That's what you got to do. This is clearly the wrong direction for the country. What is wrong that the Democratic Party itself is now jumping up and down in joy embracing this agreement?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Have you been following Randall Terry's campaign for Congress? He's running against Maurice Hinchey.
I have not. I am aware of it. I've seen some things, but no.
I heard
how low can you go, you know, if you want to follow that?
Well, I heard an interview, and he's going to appeal to a lot of people. He's got slogans about how he wants a federal law mandate that repeals property taxes, and how if we'd all just give up our cushy little government subsidies, we could stop paying federal income tax altogether forever for our children's lives, for our grandchildren's lives. This is the platform he's running on.
Well, you know, I'm glad you bring this up.
The person interviewing him
mm-hmm.
didn't stop and say, who's going to pay for all the other stuff? If we're not paying property taxes and we're not paying income taxes, where's that money going to come from?
I'm glad you brought that up, because it goes back to my original theme, which is about the link between our economic morality and between our morality and our economic structure. He has made a big moral issue out of being against abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he has no qualms whatsoever about plunging millions, tens of millions of children into desperation. So there is a mismatch there. If they did not have this thing, they're against abortion, or in the case of others, we're against homosexuality, which is all part of the same package.
Mm-hmm.
These are the moral issues they preach, while other moral issues, which I think are considerably more significant, although that's a complicated issue. I don't want to just dismiss the abortion claims, because people are some legitimately concerned about that.
So I'll say they're equally important.
Well, I just don't want to dismiss it. If you think it's genocide, I think you have to take that issue seriously.
That's what I'm saying. So they're equally important as the issues you're about to bring up.
Well, you know, both issues of genocide. Killing children after they're born is just as serious if you think it's killing them before they're born. But I don't happen to believe that that's murder when you kill a fetus. So I don't have that belief, but I don't want to belittle that belief. The only point I'm making is they are using these supposed moral issues, some of which are more legitimate than others, as the wedge in a drive towards economic objectives, which are themselves immoral.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a link. There's a link. And you're right. Randall Terry exactly exemplifies another piece of it.
And this is the new wave. It's not that if we accept this budget deal as it is right now, we are going to be at the promised land, everything will be fine. No. What this budget deal is going to do is it's going to mean 4 years from now, the federal government will be in such straits that it's going to have to cut back on social programs again, because that's the only thing they'll ever cut out of the federal government.
Well, okay.
And so it's this cycle of how much more can we cut? Next year, can we force a bigger cut? You feel like this person who keeps compromising and keep compromising, only the compromise each time comes out of my half. And so, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But the only thing I would take exception to, and I wouldn't take exception, but I would question in what you're saying, is it's difficult to assess from this moment in history if the Randall Terry campaign and the Pat Buchanan campaign, which is, of course, the same thing, represent the end point of lunacy that will never be fulfilled. These people will never run the country, even though they represent the fulfillment of the latent tendencies of the current national mindset. That's not the way it will go. The country will get so desperate that it will wake up and reverse itself, just as it did when it moved back in the direction of Roosevelt in an earlier period. Maybe Randall Terry doesn't represent the wave of the future.
I can only hope so, but I listened to him speaking on the radio, and it just amazes me that common sense couldn't break the interviewer out of, well, let me tell us more about the next platform on your thing, rather than saying, that sounds absolutely absurd. How do you propose to make it work? Just like the press couldn't possibly ask Reagan or Bush, how are you going to raise military spending and cut taxes at the same time? How does that work?
Yeah, all right, I'm with you. I think we'll see. That's what we're going to see. I am not convinced that that's the way it's going to go. I'm hoping it's not. But to me, that is the big question. Is America going to move in the direction of socialism, or whatever, not to be a socialist country, but move back that way towards income redistribution, or are we going to move in the direction of fascism? We're clearly moving in the direction of fascism now. How that's going to play out in the end, that remains to be seen, but that, of course, is the great worry. And
I don't know. I had more hope for the rest of the world helping us along our way until I heard today that the big mega merger was approved by the European Union.
The Boeing and
Donald Douglas.
Well, I think that they were pressured into doing it. I don't think there was any doubt it was going to go that way. But I think that's just
well, the fact that they stood up in the first place. I it's another one of those common sense things. How can somebody own 70% of the market and not control the market?
Well, how could they say that it was competitive? We have antitrust laws to maintain competition, mm-hmm. and now they're saying we can have the two big aircraft giants merge because they can compete with the Europeans. Well, antitrust was meant to make competition within the United States, not against the Europeans. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing is absurd, but I don't want to get sidetracked. The only point that is relevant to what we're talking about, I'm talking about tonight, is that it's a global phenomenon. Global capitalism is having its kind of frothing at the mouth heyday, and they're doing this on a global basis. But anyway, I want to move on.
It's very hard for America to turn around because we're no longer arguing with our corporations. We're arguing with the world corporations now.
Well, true, but the first thing is you have to see what's happening before you can do anything about it, and that's the real question, is whether or not people will see what's happening. And I would argue, Joe, that more powerful than all the media outlets from which the left is disenfranchised is the great power of reality. How long can they possibly keep on saying there is no effect from these policies when there is an effect? Because sooner or later, mom and pop America are going to be on that soup kitchen line reading the headlines that there's been no increase in soup kitchen usage. And they're going to be watching while all of their neighbors and Ethel and Mabel and everybody they ever knew is on that soup line. And they're still going to be being told that there's no problem there. So sooner or later, it's just going to have to wear off. That's my hope.
One would have thought that it would have worn off well before now.
Yeah, I would have too, but who knows? The stock market is still up. Nothing seems to wear off anymore. Maybe we're in eternal bliss. Thanks for the call, Joe. It was good talking to you.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Speaking of the stock market, let me read to you what Paul Volcker said. This is from the Democratic Chronicle on the 29th. Paul Volcker, the former Federal Reserve Chairman who tamed inflation in the 1980s, says investors are arrogantly unprepared for when the stock market boom eventually slows or stops. In an interview with Forbes magazine, Volcker was sharply critical of the mindset driving Wall Street's bull market. All you young people think this great boom in the stock market is normal, that you're entitled to 15% a year. These expectations cannot be met over the next 15 years. Volcker is quoted as saying in Forbes' August 11th issue, the stock market in 15 years would have to be 60,000, he said. Well, remember that word, arrogance. The point is, even a guy like Paul Volcker, who was Greenspan before Greenspan was Greenspan, even a guy like Paul Volcker is saying that this is nuts. You know, it's not. We're no longer talking about Doug Henwood from the Left Business Observer, who's been a regular guest on this show, saying that maybe all the laws of economics have somehow been suspended and this thing can go up forever. He's saying with a bemused laugh in his voice, like, you know, when is this thing going to halt? Even Paul Volcker is saying that. Even one of the architects of the current system is saying that. And somehow they have managed to make people go hungry, while at the same time they are believing that their wealth will increase forever. And of course there's a connection between the two. Where do you think their money is coming from? It's coming out of the mouths of the people who are going hungry. But that is a moral choice. That's not just an economic choice. That is a moral choice. And meanwhile, people are being thrown crumbs. This is the new thing here. This is the new thing, to make us all compete like so many snapping terriers wishing to get a dog treat from master. That's the new thing. So Clinton will fly to Lake Tahoe and extol the virtues of cleaning up an environment when it is profitable for casinos, which is what we're talking about. Here's from the Times on the 27th of this month. Renewing his call to make citizen service a vital part of American life, President Clinton said today that 1,600 high school students with outstanding records as volunteers would get scholarships of as much as $1,000 to help pay college expenses. Mr. Clinton said the scholarships had grown out of his administration's pledge last year to offer $500 scholarships to high school juniors and seniors with the best records of service in their class, if their communities and private service organizations would match that amount. The matching money came from the American Legion, Kiwanis International Rotary International, Kiwanis International Rotary International, the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks, the Lions Clubs International, the Junior Leagues, and the Miss America Foundation, the president said. Those groups were, quote, giving our young people another reason to give something back to our communities, he said, unquote. Now, you know, part of this budget deal is they're going to have another $500 tax credit or something for education or for college. Maybe it's $1,500. What happened to the idea, you know, these parties in Washington embracing over this deal? They represent two pools of thought for the same misconception. That's all it is. That's all it is. What happened to the real other idea? We have no real national debate. How about government-subsidized universities? How about government-subsidized education? Because it is a national interest of the United States to have people educated, not sitting listlessly in the chairs because they haven't got enough to eat and can't learn. And so this is what we have touted now. Dylan said it best, 20 years of schooling and they put you on the day shift. But that was 30 years ago. When you got on the day shift, now it's 20 years of working as a volunteer, you get 500 lousy bucks to go to college when a good education in this country costs tens of thousands of dollars to get. This is an obscenity. And this is the President of the United States pretending to be a good guy, saying, what a wonderful thing we've done. We will throw 1,600 high school students who work like dogs as volunteers $500 when every able student who wants an education in this country should be able to get one, just like every able-bodied person who needs a job should be able to get one, and every disabled person who cannot work should be cared for, and the money is there with which to do it. You know, here is a little thing from the, what have we got here? The Ithaca Journal. Little thing, what's in it for you about the federal budget? Let me just, talking about children's health insurance, some provision there, you know, another little of these things they're throwing a doggy treat here. They have a $24 billion thing over 5 years to help pay for more children's health care. It says here, the generally accepted number of uninsured children is $10 million. And then in another place in this article, it says, the National Association for Child Advocates says $900 per year is what it costs to provide the average child's medical care. That's averaging it out across. Well, if you say there's 10 million children and $900 a year, that's $9 billion is what it is needed to provide medical care for all of the uninsured children. $9 billion. The budget package allows $24 billion over five. Let's call it $5 billion a year. We have a shortfall of $4 billion a year. $4 billion a year is the shortfall difference between this budget and one that would pay for all the medical care for all the uninsured children. $4 billion is the cost of two B-2 bombers at the current production run and prices. Two B-2 bombers. We are not even having a debate in this country about that. And one of the great misconceptions is that there is any philosophical debate going on in this country, that you would have one party on one side, one group of people on one side saying smaller government, lower taxation for the rich, da-da-da-da-da, and the other side is saying some other philosophy about income redistribution. We are not having that debate because nobody stood up to say, let's pay for health care for the sick children. Nobody rose to say that. It's not in the debate. There is no debate. Nobody rose, just as Joe from Ithaca said, to say, why are we wasting our money on these military things if we have a limited pot of money such that we've got to make children go hungry and we can't pay their health care? Let's take a look at our expenditures. Do we need this B-2? Do we need the Star Wars defense? Do we need this? Do we need that? Nobody even rose. Maybe they did, but it was never reported. It was never part of the national psyche. It's not in Washington. We're not hearing about that. This is not a thing that's being discussed. There's no faction rising to say, if we are having times that are tight, let it be tight for everybody. Let it not just be tight for the children who are hungry. Let the times be tight for the industrialists who are getting fat. Let the times be tight for the generals in the Pentagon who can order anything they want off of their wish list. Nobody rose to say that. There's been no debate in this country. But we do have a big message in this country about sodomy. And we'll talk more about that in its relation to the national budget after 5 minutes of NPR News.
When the idle poor become the idle rich, you'll never know just who is who or who is which. Won't it be rich when everyone's poor relative becomes a rocker relative and Tom's no longer it? What a switch!
When we all have urban fantastic teeth, how will we determine who's who underneath?
And when all your neighbors are upper class,
you won't know your Joneses from your asters.
Let's toast the day we drink a drinky up, but with the